This morning, America's First News starts right after this.
How would you love a chance to save some money on car insurance? GEICO can help. Switch today and see all the ways you could save with great rates and discounts. It's easy. Simply go to geico.com to get a rate quote and get started seeing how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This morning, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Will it be Biden versus Trump in 2024? Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koshenka. Independence Day, Monday, July 4th. Thanks for being with us. Here's what we have for you this hour.
Could the top contenders from the 2020 election face each other again in 2 years? Hear the potential of a Biden versus Trump repeat.
A new survey finds we're not as generous these days when tipping. Hear what's changed since the outset of the pandemic.
On this July 4th holiday, some facts you might not have known about Independence Day, including about food traditions.
And how 2022 has become extremely expensive for wedding guests.
2022 is just biggest year for weddings since, I believe, 1984 is what researchers have found. So big boom for the wedding industry this year, mostly because a lot of couples had to push back their plans due to the pandemic. So we're seeing increased demand just because of those setbacks there.
Bailey Schultz at USA Today on how much it costs to attend a wedding this year. Well, one of the longtime contributors to this program is changing hats, Josh Kraushaar, veteran politics editor and columnist at National Journal, is stepping down to join Axios this month. He joins us now to discuss his final piece for National Journal. Josh, your take on D.C. politics.
I've been covering politics for almost 20 years and been doing the column for 12 years, where I always tried to come up with contrarian, independent analysis that goes against the conventional wisdom. And so I went into the thanks that I gave to editors and sources and even critics in the column. But I also wanted to talk about my final against the grain analysis, which is I don't see Biden and Trump running against each other in the next presidential election. I actually think we're kind of looking at the past to guide our future thinking. I think there are a lot of smoke signals that, especially on the Democratic side, that Biden too old, too damaged politically to run again. And I think there's some really important indicators that Trump is having some challenges, having challenges consolidating support, having the same degree of support at least that he did as president within the Republican field.
The fourth paragraph in your piece to me captures so much. And you started by saying, you talk about these worrisome aspects of suffocating tribalism. And you said more news consumers seek validation of their political beliefs. What's the problem with that?
Well, look, it's the state of our politics, Gordon. The fact that you have Americans that don't want to learn, they don't want to get facts, but they want to read or engage in content that already kind of supports what they already believe, whether it's true or not, whether it's new or not. And, you know, it makes it hard. Increasingly, it's not just in politics where you have Republicans pandering to Trump, where you have Democrats pandering to the furthest left elements of their party, but it also affects the media. And if that's what people want, a lot of institutions, including some pretty traditional mainstream ones, are catering to the extremes. They're catering to the folks who want their partisan or ideological instincts indulged. And I think that's a big challenge that isn't just going to be a big issue in our politics, but in our larger institutions going forward.
We're speaking with Josh Kraushaar, politics editor at National Journal, where he is resigning and leaving for Axios. His final piece is called Saying Goodbye to National Journal. You said, too, there's not much what you called ideological diversity in the media. When you reference the media here, do you mean columnists or TV opinion journalists, all reporters, or who do you include there?
I'm just talking about the news industry in general, and that includes just traditional news institutions where you're not seeing as many people who have, forget about who you voted for. I don't think that's really important, but you're not seeing blue collar folks you know, moving their way up and getting jobs in the media. You're not seeing folks with conservative perspectives, by and large. There's some exceptions, clearly, but by and large, reporting. And then that leads to some blind spots. I think a lot of the challenges in the media aren't so much challenges of commission, where you're, you know, the story is biased or it's horrible. I think, by and large, reporters work hard and try to get things right. But I think the bigger challenge is missing a whole lot of important stories. Missing, for example, I wrote a lot about the education issue being a really significant factor in the Virginia governor's race and in our larger politics. A lot of folks were slow to catch up on that. They didn't realize some of the debates going on, some of the parental frustrations that were taking place all across the country until the election was already held. And I think that you see blind spots in areas like that end up, you know, not giving the full story or not giving the full context of what's happening in our larger politics.
And so to do a deeper dive on that, what do you attribute that to? Laziness, lousy training, poor editors, I don't know, bias coming from the top?
Yeah, I don't think there's one factor, but I do think I think diversity matters, and it's not, you need racial and ethnic and demographic diversity, but it also ideological diversity is very important. You know, understanding where the other half of the country is coming from, understanding where people who, you know, didn't go to the Ivy League schools, what their values are, what their principles are, being able to listen and understand the other side. And you don't have to have that same background, but it certainly helps to have a newsroom with all sorts of diversity. And I think on the class element and on the ideological element, you do see a lot more homogeneity in a lot of major newsrooms across the country. I think we'd be better served if we recruited from big state schools, if we recruited across the country, if we recruited from folks with untraditional backgrounds, because that's what it takes to get good reporting and a good look at what's going on in the country.
Thanks, Josh. Josh Kraushaar joining Axios. Coming up next, discussing mental health at work. Dell's Black Friday in July sale is here. Power productivity with a tech refresh, now with up to 45% off top-rated laptops like the XPS, along with our special deals on business desktops with Intel Core processors. Get big savings on the latest servers, storage, monitors, and more with free shipping and special financing with Dell Business Credit. Upgrade today by calling 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL. Glad you could spend part of your holiday with us. According to a new Fast Company Harris poll, employees are still afraid to discuss mental health at work. The survey found 47% said their job had negatively impacted their mental health. Another 43% said their mental health negatively impacted their job performance. In-depth analysis from Lee Richardson, licensed counselor and founder of the Brain Performance Center in Dallas. Lee, help us out.
Well, you know, Gordon, the way I see it is employees are still trying to be ensured that they're going to be able to have a hybrid work schedule, that they're going to be able to work from home as much as they want to. And a lot of corporations have taken a stance and said, yes, we'll do it, but a lot haven't. And I think that's playing into some people's security. They've learned that they can work very effectively from home. They've learned that their stress is much level. They don't have commute time. They don't have to worry about elder care or child care as much. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of stress going on that's creating more mental health issues, and they don't feel secure that they in their work environment at this point.
Boy, when you say there are more mental health issues possibly developing, it makes me think, first, we don't know how to talk about it. And then on top of that, we may be falling further behind if we're developing more issues, no?
You're right. And when I say more issues, it all comes from uncertainty. And until we get more certain, there's still a lot of people, Gordon, that are very concerned about the virus. And there's still a lot of people that are very concerned about how they will be able, if they will be able to move forward. I see those at the Brain Performance Center. And I think that we need to stabilize, and once we stabilize, then we can start to feel comfortable talking about things. And it's hard. It's easy to talk about, you know, about the basketball game that's going to go on tonight, or are your kids. But it's hard to talk about your mental health.
Yeah.
It's hard to talk about the fact that you don't get any sleep at night because you lay there and you toss and turn and you ruminate. You've got those thoughts going over and over in your head.
You were saying something that made me think of this, and I don't know what it was, but it made me wonder, what about the age of some of today's managers? You know, some of us were brought up ignoring mental health issues, right? Like, suck it up or get over yourself, you know, was the phrase that was used. Is that possibly at play here? Like, that we don't understand maybe how to recognize if somebody's having an issue or how to encourage somebody to talk about it?
Absolutely, Gordon. I think you bring up a really valid point. And, you know, for so long, it has not been okay to not be okay. And how do we make that shift? How do we just kind of, it comes with education and it comes with putting some energy into understanding mental health to reduce that stigma. But, you know, if there's not a reason to do it, why do it? And I think that, you know, did you know over 4 million people quit their job in March? I mean, these are just, and this, the Great Resignation started back in the fall.
Yeah.
These are unusual times. And I think that we all need to become more in tune with what it takes to keep people engaged and to keep them. And I think it's hard to feel part of the team when I haven't seen the team in a couple months.
Sure. We're speaking with Lee Richardson, licensed professional counselor, also founder of the Brain Performance Center in Dallas. And we're talking about employees afraid to discuss mental health at work. And I think, too, it's been pointed out there are just not enough mental health resources on the job. What would enough, I guess, look like, Lee?
Well, that's a really good question. I think enough has more to do with how they're communicated than how many there are. Because I know a lot of companies have EAP programs, but their when I talk with my clients, I'm like, well, does your company have an EAP program? Huh?
What does that mean? What's EAP?
Yeah, that's Employee Assistance Program, So that they do have some benefits set up for mental health. But if it's not communicated and your employees may even know it exists, but they don't know how to access it, it doesn't do very much good. So, you know, my suggestion would be let's put the emphasis on how we communicate the resources that are out there.
Is it possible that a mental health issue can become a self-fulfilling prophecy at times?
Absolutely. I honestly believe that, because I believe that if you get up and you tell yourself, you know, or you pay attention to your body and you're nauseous and you feel, you know, a little bit dizzy, and you feel, because with mental health issues, you have physical health issues at the same time, Gordon.
Yeah.
And if you just pay attention to those physical health issues, I mean, that brain kicks in. You don't need to go to work today. You need to take care of your body. And the kicker is, when it's all in your brain and your mind, that same message does not kick in.
Thanks, Lee. Lee Richardson from the Brain Performance Center in Dallas. Coming up next, why we've become less generous tippers. Thanks for spending part of your Monday with us. Although many Americans vowed to become better tippers because of the financial impact of COVID on service industry employees, new data from creditcards.com shows they failed to follow through. Here's this morning's Jennifer Koshenka.
For a while during the pandemic, we felt bad for people working in service industries. Apparently, that's no longer the case. As Ted Rossman of creditcards.com tells us, we are worse tippers today than before COVID hit. Ted, what has happened first to restaurant tipping?
It's gone down, at least in terms of the percentage of people who always tip, from 77% in 2019 to 75% in 2021. Now it's down to 73%. There's certain groups that really stand out, though. Only 52% of Gen Zers always tip at a restaurant. That's really low. Only 60% of millennials always tip. That goes up to 87% of boomers. Now, the average is 21%. So when people tip, they tip pretty well. But I think the real point here is a lot of people are leaving nothing, and that's disappointing.
What about rideshare drivers and some of the other categories that you looked at?
Yeah, things really go downhill from here, because I mentioned there's room for improvement at restaurants. I think there's a lot of room for improvement elsewhere, because we found that only two-thirds of people always tip their hairstylist or barber. Only 57% always tip for food delivery, and then it goes below 50%. Taxi and rideshare drivers only get a tip from 43% of people who tip every time. For housekeepers at the hotel or coffee shop baristas, it's only about 1 in 4 who always tip. So a lot of people could stand to do a lot better, I think.
Do we have any idea why the tipping is less now today than before COVID?
A couple of theories. One would be inflation just squeezing people's purchasing power, although, you know, not to be harsh, but there is a school of thought, like if you can't afford to tip appropriately, maybe you shouldn't go to that restaurant or you should go to a cheaper one. But I wonder if that's part of it. I think the other thing is that we keep hearing about these staffing shortages, and some of these businesses may not be giving the best service these days. They're just kind of run ragged by the staffing shortage. I know we hear about that at restaurants. That one is tough, too, though, because restaurant wait staff really depend on these tips to make a living. So I think that it's harsh to take the tip away because, you know, you waited too long for a table or your food wasn't quite right. I mean, I think unless it's something really, really bad, I would try not to hit the server in the wallet. It may not even be their fault. You know, it may be something more with the maitre d' or the kitchen, or but these are some of the things we hear.
We're speaking with Ted Rossman of creditcards.com. Ted, could the numbers be somewhat skewed because in the beginning of the pandemic, we felt so awful for the people who had to be out around other people while some of us got to stay home?
I think that's part of it. I think there's also a disconnect sometimes between what people say and what they do. We know inflation has squeezed people. I think some of the demographics are really interesting on this because generally speaking, the older you are and the more money you make, the better of a tipper you are. And I guess that makes sense. But what's surprising is that for a group like Gen Zers or millennials or men for that matter, all three of those groups, they tend to tip less often. But when they tip more generously, which I thought was notable.
Your story notes that there are sometimes places that suggest a certain tip be left. Does that make people angry, or do we heed those advice?
The data actually shows that it's positive. 26% tip more when they're encountering a suggested tip amount. 12% tip less. Most people are more or less unchanged. This surprised me as well. I thought there would be more anger here because I hear a lot of complaints anecdotally about this so-called tip creep. Like you're at a coffee shop or food truck, and it's really more of just a counter service kind of thing. You're not necessarily thinking that you're going to tip. And then they flip that tablet around and you see the pre-entered amounts and the cashier's looking at you and you feel kind of awkward. I hear that a lot of people are upset by that, but the data shows that it actually leads to higher tips. So I suppose that's a big part of why they do it. It's strategic, too, the amounts they pick. And Uber is like this as well. Do you do 10, 15, 20? Do you do 15, 20, 25? It's kind of human nature to pick that middle amount.
That's this morning's Jennifer Koshenka with Ted Rossman, industry analyst at creditcards.com. 30 minutes after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Want to eat healthier, but every supplement you've ever tried seems like the better it is for you, the worse it tastes? Then you have to try AG1 from Athletic Greens. I started taking AG1 because I wanted more energy and better gut health. What I didn't expect, the taste is better than any supplement I've ever had. I drink it, like it says, before anything else when I wake up. I guzzle those 8 to 10 ounces before my coffee and start my day knowing I've already gotten the recommended daily intake of all the good fruits and veggies. There's definitely a mental boost knowing you've started the day off on the right foot. I tackle the day now with more confidence and energy. AG1, by the way, is not only lifestyle friendly, it's cheaper than getting all the different supplements yourself. Try AG1. I love this product. To make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free 1-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/Gordon. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/Gordon to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. athleticgreens.com/Gordon. Thanks for joining us on this Monday, Independence Day. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka coming up this half hour. The cost to attend a wedding these days. Also, do you really save by not having kids? And little known facts about July 4th. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Well, a recent survey found that guests can expect to spend upwards of $1,300 to attend just one out-of-state wedding this year. And the average wedding guest this year is invited to five weddings and attending four. Who can afford that? Here's Bailey Schultz, money reporter at USA Today. Bailey, set the scene.
Yes, as someone who is in their mid-20s and having a wedding myself this year, I'm very familiar with how crazy a year it is for weddings, where going to friends, planning my own. And so 2022 is just biggest year for weddings since, I believe, 1984 is what researchers have found. So big boom for the wedding industry this year, mostly because a lot of couples had to push back their plans due to the pandemic. So we're seeing increased demand just because of those setbacks there. But not only does that affect couples and what they're spending for weddings this year, but guests are also seeing costs have to go up, not only because they're invited so many weddings this year, but we're also seeing other factors like inflation really impact just the spending for all these events.
Boy, I was just going to say, right smack in the middle of when inflation's at like a 40-year high. What are some of those costs that couples are facing? Because like, even like, you know, food when you're traveling to the wedding, if you have to go far.
Yeah. So there was a recent report that came out from Zola, which is a wedding website, and they surveyed about 2,500 people. But what they found is if you're going to a wedding within driving distance, guests are having to pay an average of $593 to attend. If you fly, costs go up to like a little more than $1,300. So this obviously adds up very fast if you are attending multiple weddings this year. But not only is it travel costs with the flights and the driving with gas prices now, but people are spending more for lodging with hotels nowadays. And then there's, like you mentioned, food when you're outside the house, and just everything is costing more now with inflation. So guests are really seeing that make an impact when they're attending all these events.
Wow. We're speaking with Bailey Schultz, money reporter at USA Today. She's written a story that's called "How Much Does It Cost to Attend a Wedding? Why 2022 is a Very Expensive Year for Guests." Sorry, so you mentioned before you're getting married. Congratulations, by the way. I mean, short of robbing a bank, I mean, how are you supposed to kind of hold costs down when you've got your own and you have to attend others?
I think that's what people are grappling with, where I spoke to someone for the story where he and his fiance were invited to 12 weddings this year. Can't attend all of them. Some are on the same day, and it's just too many. So I think they're going to 8 or 9. But with those alone, that's going to cost them about $5,000. And then they're planning their own wedding, which is costing them another $40,000 or so. So obviously, this adds up very fast. And why I spoke to wedding guests and other people who are attending weddings and planning their own, they are making cuts in other places where maybe they're going out less, they're traveling less. I talked to one couple who is actually cutting down some costs for their own wedding and putting it into their funds for attending other weddings. So people are having to make cuts in other areas to make sure they can attend all these events.
Boy, yeah, I know you swapped notes with the one woman. I think she's of Indian descent, and she's saying, like, for us, you know, the stuff we wear is really expensive, and she's got multiple invitations.
Yeah, that definitely plays a factor as well with certain cultures, just having to spend more on clothing and other items. And for a lot of these weddings, it's not only just a one-day event. It can be multiple days long that you're having to travel and you have the lodging, and just adds up very quickly.
So we need you, Bailey, to start the trend, postpone till 2023 or 2024 when things calm down.
There you go. Yeah, hopefully we see prices settle down. I think that's what everyone's hoping for at this point.
Wow. What else did you hear? What else, are folks doing or pulling their hair out for?
I think that's just it. Where surprisingly, what this Zola survey found was that people are spending more, people are invited to more weddings, but overall, people are still excited. I mean, we went through a weird, rough couple of years, and people want to go out and see people again and celebrate and have a happy occasion, like a wedding, where they can see people again. So despite these rising prices, we're seeing people are overall still excited to go, even if it's costing them more this year.
Thanks, Bailey. Bailey Schultz at USA Today. Coming up next, how much money do you actually save by not having kids? Thanks for spending part of your July 4th with us. Traditional financial plans often boil down to worrying about children, how much to save for college, how much insurance to buy, or how best to set up wills and trusts. That playbook does not work for people who choose not to have kids. A growing number of child-free adults in the U.S. are seeking advice about spending, saving, and investing tailored to their situation. More from Veronica Dagger, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Veronica, explain.
So more people are choosing not to have kids. Now, this is people intentionally saying, I don't want to have children. And because of that, my financial needs are different. You know, as you know, so much of financial planning boils down to worrying about children, how to save for their college education, how much insurance to buy, how to set up a will or a trust. But if you don't have kids, you don't have generally don't have those things to worry about. So their needs are different.
Yeah. So what's the advice for them?
For example, you know, one financial planner I spoke to said life insurance really isn't a given for those without kids. So it's a lot more important to have disability insurance because many of this financial advisor's clients who don't have kids, they're also unmarried. And so they lack a second income to fall back on. So that's one piece of advice to consider. Also think about, you don't have to pass on this large estate. So people who are without children are thinking about spending and giving their money away more so during their lifetimes than people with kids. And so you might have a bigger focus on charitable giving for people who don't have children.
What are some of the reasons people traditionally give, Veronica, for choosing not to have kids?
You know, it varies. I mean, it's everything from climate change, you know, worries about climate change, this ongoing pandemic, uncertainty in the world, the expense of having kids. Some people just want the time, the freedom, and they want that, the ability to do what they want when they want to do that. I also hear people saying, you know, maybe I didn't have such a great childhood myself, and so I don't want to pass that on. You hear some of that. But in general, the reasons really vary.
We're speaking with Veronica Dagger, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Her story is called, How Much Money Do You Really Save by Not Having Kids? These folks, I guess if they do things right, generally can retire a little earlier than the rest of us with kids.
Yes, big advantage. You don't have to have as much savings. You have fewer expenses. Technically, you could live in a smaller home, drive a smaller car. You might be able to pay off your own student loans sooner, and you might have more time to pursue a career and really put your foot on the gas in that regard. And so because of that, you end up with more money potentially, and then you can leave the workforce sooner. The ability to also pursue your passions versus pursue a job that you need to have just to pay the bills is another advantage that people without kids may have over people who are parents.
Easy to pivot careers, I think somebody referenced in your piece too.
Yeah, exactly. Pivot careers, start your own business. When you don't have any mouths to feed, you can kind of do a little bit more of what you want to do when you want to do it.
Right. I think it was a point made in your story too. You may then have, or you likely have, the flexibility to take care of aging parents, or you'd be expected to do that if you don't have kids.
Right. So people without kids are often looked upon by their siblings, by their parents, as future caretakers of those aging parents. And because of that, you know, for right or for wrong, people look to them. And because of that, they have to think about how they're going to budget their time and also their money. If your parents are leaning on you financially as you age, you're going to want to put some extra savings aside to help take care of them. And so some of the planners are thinking about that. How much do you need to put aside over the years in case you have to kick in to help your parents? And so that is an added burden. So it isn't all freedom for some of these folks. It's also some extra responsibility.
And it's generally said, I guess, through studies that adults with no children have a higher education?
Higher education, they tend to have more money in general. So they're doing better financially than people who are parents. And so that's something else. I think young people look around today and they say, you know what? I see my older relatives who don't have kids and they're going on vacation or they're working remotely in Greece and having an amazing time. I want that life too.
That's Veronica Dagger, reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Coming up next, tracking flags that are promised to Americans. Dell's Black Friday in July sale is here. Power productivity with a tech refresh, now with up to 45% off top-rated laptops like the XPS, along with our special deals on business desktops with Intel Core processors. Get big savings on the latest servers, storage, monitors, and more with free shipping and special financing with Dell Business Credit. Upgrade today by calling 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL. Glad you could be with us. Welcome into a Monday, Independence Day. Well, if people can find out when their pizza is out for delivery, they should be able to see when a flag from their member of Congress is headed their way, too. That's what a congressional staffer wants to figure out. It's a story by Chris Chaffee, congressional reporter at CQ Roll Call. Chris, what's up here?
Congress has this program where you can request a flag that's flown over the Capitol from your senator or from your congressman, and about 100,000 flags flow through this program every year. And of course, when you request a flag, you know, sometimes you're requesting it for a special event that has a date, and so sometimes constituents call aides or staffers at the Capitol. Typically they're junior staffers, and they, you know, wonder where their flag is. And so the way the system works now, it's kind of this like process where there's several offices involved and there's not a lot of information for staffers right at their fingertips. So they end up having to run around calling these different offices to kind of try and get more information about where this constituent's flag is. And so these staffers who are members of the Modernization Staff Association kind of saw themselves spending a lot of time on several of these issues that junior staffers are responsible for. So it's tracking flags, it's making room reservations, it's making tour reservations. And so what these staffers did was, you know, they, after they formed the Staffer Association, they approached both the Senate Sergeant at Arms and the Chief Administrative Officer over in the House and basically said, you know, hey, we know that there's a different process in both the House and the Senate to request and then receive a flag. Is there a way we can make it easier, not only for you guys, but for staffers as well? So yeah, when someone calls, they can just see it right away instead of having to, you know, do this crazy phone tag.
Right. So you met this woman, Ananda Bhatia. She seems to be spearheading this, right? What does she want to do? Create an app or something?
Yeah, she called it the Domino's Pizza Tracker for Flags, basically. And yeah, and so she's the founder of the Modernization Staff Association. And so the idea is basically to come up with a system to, yeah, have it right at your fingertips. And so, yeah, you just, like, you know, when you order a pizza, you can see whether it's out for delivery or whether it's still in the oven. They want that to be the case for flags. So, yeah, when someone calls, you can say, oh, yep, here it is. You know, it'll be out in, you know, X number of days, or here's where it is in the process. So, you know, it just kind of saves everyone time and a lot of headaches.
We're speaking with Chris Chaffee, congressional reporter at CQ Roll Call. His story is called Thousands of Flags Fly Over the Capitol, and a couple of legislative staffers want to track them. I didn't realize it was this complicated a process. I guess it's not surprising, given that it's Congress, I guess. What kind of support are they getting, if any, to kind of get a project like this done?
To address the first part, right, yes, Congress can have its own processes, and sometimes they are a little bit confusing. Of course, you know, in any of these cases, whether it's a Senate dining contract or a House dining contract, or even the way staffers are paid, both the Senate and House have separate systems. And so that can kind of cause some troubles, you know, when you're trying to come up with a pizza tracker for flags, because you have to have sort of a two-track approach, right? You initially, they thought, well, let's have one system to rule them all. But of course, the issue was, well, the Senate does things one way and they have their systems, and jeez, the House has their system and they do things their way, right? And so they actually came to the table at these meetings with the CAO and the SAA, that's the House Chief Administrative Officer, and the Senate Sergeant at Arms, just in case you wanted more acronyms. And so basically, they had an app that was built by a group at Code for America, and they said, here, this is what it could look like. You know, how can we make this happen? And so on both sides of the Capitol, they're still in the process. There hasn't been a final app yet, but they're hopeful that, you know, something like this could work to really improve some of these tasks that junior staffers have to deal with.
Thanks, Chris. Chris Chaffee, Congress reporter at CQ Roll Call. Coming up next, some little-known facts about Independence Day. How would you love a chance to save some money on car insurance? GEICO can help. Switch today and see all the ways you could save with great rates and discounts. It's easy. Simply go to geico.com to get a rate quote and get started seeing how much you could save. We'll finish with this. Growing up, you may have heard that we celebrate Independence Day on July 4th because that's the day the Founding Fathers signed the Declaration of Independence. But that's not technically true. Although the Declaration was adopted on July 4, 1776, it wasn't signed by most people until a month later. Parade.com has other interesting facts. Number one, on July 2nd, 1776, the Continental Congress voted in favor of declaring independence from Great Britain. The Declaration of Independence was officially adopted 2 days later, marked by the ringing of the Liberty Bell at Independence Hall in Philadelphia. Number two, Americans typically eat 150 million hot dogs on Independence Day. The National Hot Dog and Sausage Council says that's enough to stretch from D.C. to L.A. more than five times. Fact three, the famed Macy's Fireworks Show in New York City uses more than 75,000 fireworks shells and cost about $6 million. And fact four, eating salmon is a July 4 tradition in parts of New England. I was not aware of that. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News.